The letter to Pergamum. Okay, here we go. So we have the map up on the screen, as you see. This is Asia Minor, what we know as Turkey. So this is modern-day Turkey, was known as Asia Minor then. We started in Ephesus because it's a port city, and this is the mailing, this is the postal route that it runs. But we began in Ephesus, this massive city, very, very important because it is a port city. So anything moving from east to west in trade, if you're doing any kind of trade, you're going to run through Ephesus. You have to go through there as a marketplace. Then we went up to Smyrna. Smyrna was the original capital of Asia Minor in the day. It was the original capital, and then it was at one point usurped, though, by Pergamum, which was then later usurped by Ephesus. So then we go up, and we're now in Pergamum, this fantastic and brilliant city, which actually, when we get into the city, Pergamum has an upper city and a lower city, and it's really, really important. So we'll get into that. We're going to go ahead and give my clicker another shot at working. Did it do it?
No, I didn't.
Okay, good, wonderful. So this first picture is the remains of the god Demeter, right? The god Demeter. So this is Demeter's temple in the upper city. Demeter was the god of bread. Demeter was the god of bread, referred to as manna often. So they worshiped this god, the Roman Empire. Those in the first century, a lot of them would worship the god Demeter for providing food. Our food, our provision comes from Demeter. So we bless you, Demeter. We worship you, Demeter, anytime we have a meal because you are the god that provides food. This is what they did. So this was the god of provision. Then we come to this theater. Is this not stunning? So this theater that they have excavated is on the hill, and this is the upper city, and so down below is the lower city. But this theater could seat about 10,000 people. It was the steepest theater in the ancient world, and it also had a portable stage. These people were incredibly innovative in what they did. So when we jump to the next one, this is just fantastic. Just so you can see, I'm at the top taking a picture. You see this blip down here? This is Brad, who led the trip. When he stood in the middle, he would do this. Hi, everybody. How are you doing? And he would talk with just a normal voice, and we all stood up top, and we said, hey, Brad, how are you? And we could hear him perfectly fine. And then he would talk, and he would talk, and he would do this. He would walk over here and he'd keep talking, and all of a sudden we can't hear him anymore. Then he would walk to the middle, and all of a sudden his voice was booming because they designed it for sound because they were brilliant at doing that. And so you could hear, no matter where you sat in the stadium, if the person on the stage is in the right spot, you could hear them just fine at a normal tone. Then we go into holes are where they had, this is where the portable staging went. And so they could move stuff, and so they could shift the scenery, and they would do things which were like, yeah, 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 big deal. Okay, 2,000 and some years ago, what that looked like to have this. And if you're like, well, why is the theater such a big deal? Why would we talk about the theater and they preserve the theater? The theater is the main way. It's one of the central ways in which you would communicate your value. If you're going to communicate values to a large audience, well, where can you gather them? You can gather them here, and when you have them here, through plays, all different kinds of plays, theater, entertainment things, you can actually get your values through that. We'll tell you what we value by how we entertain, which is really different than today, right? Do we not watch movies and do not values come through? And do not, we go, oh, that, well, that movie obviously had an agenda. We would say, yeah, well, welcome to the theater 2,000 years ago as well. And they were really innovative. And we'll get to the theater a bit more because it'll come up. Now, in Pergamum, the Roman governor, who is also called the proconsul, the Roman governor made his home here in Pergamum. So the governor made his home here, and he carried the authority, if you take notes, this is important, he carried the authority to enact the right of the sword, this is what its legal name, the right of the sword, or it was known as the double-edged sword. And this right that he carried was the death penalty. It's what we know as the death penalty. And when he has the right of the sword, what that meant is he didn't have to go to Rome and say, hey, I'd like your permission to execute. He didn't have to because I, as the governor here, hold the right of the double-edged sword, which means I have the right to life and death. And so this guy had the power, and he lived, he kept his home here in Pergamum. And Pergamum was the home of four patron gods, the four patron gods of the Greek Roman gods. Zeus, maybe you've heard of Zeus. He is the high god known as the King of Kings, is what they referred to Zeus as. And from the incredible excavation project that they did here, they reconstructed Zeus's temple. He had a massive altar here in Pergamum. They reconstructed it and then relocated it to Berlin, Germany. And it was after they relocated it, just fun facts, when Turkey said, hey, we got to stop, we got to put in a law so you don't excavate and then take our stuff, because now guess where everybody wants to go to see the altar? Germany. Guess who doesn't get money then? Turkey. So they're like, well, we got to stop this. But when we get into his altar, here is a drawing. So this is a sketching of a couple different things, but Zeus's altar is here. And so this whole thing here is his altar. And there's going to be a bunch more coming. Oh, man, can you go back for me, please? That would be great. I think I went ahead. One, two, I'm not sure. That one's great. Can we go back one more? There we go. Okay, now go ahead. Oh, let me try it. I think I'm done with this dadgone thing. So this one, you zoom in and you actually have Zeus. So Zeus is one, and then Athena is the other one. Athena's got her arm up. Athena we're going to get into in a moment, but these patron gods, and this is from constructed. Next slide, though. We'll go there. This is the reconstruction of the front of it in the Berlin Museum there. So you can see it's massive in the detail, and this is a way in which they communicate to people. When you see this stuff, they make it big and they get it in your face. It's called marketing, and they would do this. This is what we value. This is how things go. And so Athena is also a part of this, and a part of that sketching, though, was also Athena's temple was a part of that sketching that was in Pergamum. Athena, so if you're taking notes, is the goddess of war and wisdom. She is the goddess of war and wisdom, war being the way to victory. And so they had a slogan, peace through victory. So they understood peace came about through military conquest. And Athena is the goddess of war. Her temple had a library that held 200,000 volumes of writing. It was the second biggest in the ancient world. It was massive. And we would think in terms of publishing house. If you wanted to get your writing out there, you wanted your writing in Athena's library. Why this is important is Athena being known as having this library, which gave her and noted her as wisdom, and she was the goddess of war. So here was her two things. They believed that wisdom was held here, and so the two attributes of war and wisdom led to her, Athena, being known as the way and the truth. Sound familiar? Athena is the way and the truth. So this was Athena. Then there is a third patron god, Dionysus. Go ahead and say Dionysus. Dionysus is the god of theater. So he's the god of theater. And get this, at the pronouncement of every theater play, we're going to get ready. Theater is here. 10,000 people jammed into this place. And at the beginning, they would say, thank you, we're going to begin. Everything, whether in word or deed, be done in the name of Dionysus. Oh, does that sound familiar? Anything that is done, whether in word or deed, be done in the name of Dionysus. And Dionysus is the god of the vine and wine. Essentially vine, wine. They would say this is the god of wine, but also then the god of these sex parties that they would throw. They would tie wine and sex together. And so next slide. That's just more of this. Now, we'll hold here because there's the theater. This is one of Dionysus's little, it's kind of like Dionysus's temple here that was reconstructed. And what they would do is have love feasts here. And so they would have the wealthy, they would pay lots of money to come in, and they would have prostitutes, and they would have all kinds of stuff that we won't get into, but just know that they had these sex parties, and that was all essentially in honor of Dionysus. We're going to drink a lot, and we're going to do other things, play Twister. So the Pergamenes, and this is where we get into, so there's some of the theater, and they just kept it close because people would move from the theater, and it was an opportunity for, we've not got our values out there, and oh, by the way, if you want to go to the after party, maybe you would say it, it's just down the way at Dionysus' place. Now, the Pergamenes claim to have invented, but at the very least, whether or not they invented it, at the very least, they perfected parchments for writing. Because it was scrolls, and everything was done on scrolls, but scrolls are cumbersome, and you have to roll them, and most of the time, the way the scrolls are, you can only write on one side of a scroll. So to even have them, they're so bulky and problematic. Well, the Pergamenes were known to have either invented or at least perfected parchment. Do you know what parchment is? It is largely what it would often be as sheepskins. So now you have something that's a little thicker. You can write on both sides, and oh, by the way, you can put a binding on it, and now you have what? A book. Welcome to the invention of the book. Now, what I have at home that I was telling you about is I actually went into this parchment center, and I have the letter to Pergamum from Revelation printed up on sheepskin on this thing, and then I framed it, and it's in my bedroom at home to have the letter to the church in Pergamum done on parchment. It's really quite stunning, but I didn't bring it with me, so sorry about that. But papyrus scrolls generally could only be written on one side, so they became a problem. Parchment, animal skins could be bound together, and so the invention of the book is claimed to be here. It's a big deal, because then you can fit more volumes, more writings in Athena's library. Now, the fourth patron god is the god Asclepius. Go ahead and say Asclepius. Asclepius is this feller. So, hi, Asclepius. This is the guy who is the god of healing. He is known as the god of healing and medicine. Healing and medicine. People would seek guidance from Asclepius on what they needed to do, what do they need to do to be well, to get healthy. Or if they have an affliction, how could they also be supernaturally healed? They understood you go to Asclepius for that. They expected this guidance would often happen. It would take place in dreams, is what they thought. That in their sleep, Asclepius would speak to them. And down what they did is when they excavated, they would have these beds that we went down in these rooms and they had these beds. And then if you look carefully enough, there was a little hole up above and kind of the ceiling. And what they would do is they would have someone down there and they got a broken leg. Well, they kind of like knock them out. And then they would go and they would speak into this thing. So then when they like, oh, and Asclepius spoke to me when I was unconscious and he was telling me how I would get well. Yeah. So then the lower city, which I talked about, we're going to head down to the lower city now. But you get this picture because we're going to head somewhere. I think maybe the next one is there. Yeah. Does this look familiar? What is this? This is the medical, what we have today. Do you see what our symbol is for the medical community? It's Asclepius's snake. It's his cane. That's where it came from, the god of healing and medicine. So we use that today, Asclepius's symbol. What? This is the second time, because where did the word, the brand Nike come from? The flying Nike. Nikeo, the Greek god Nikeo. Like, we just took this stuff. It's all out there. And we decided to pin it to our, like, what are we doing? That's for another talk. Next slide, then. Now we'll head down there. So this is the Asclepium in the lower city. What we would know is essentially a Mayo Clinic. This is like a hospital specialized. The best medical doctors in the world were here in Pergamum at the Asclepium. It was a healing sanctuary. The world's best physicians would be here. And there is a small theater just to your left up here. This small theater where they would only allow comedies at the Asclepium. Why? Because how do you get better? You laugh. We will have nothing that is sad or dramatic because these people need to get better. So only comedies would be taking place in this small theater. And now, the thing is, if you don't worship, and at the front of the Asclepium, there's a statue and there's a place where you essentially would offer incense, where you would worship the emperor, the Roman emperor, and Asclepius. And if you do not worship Asclepius and offer incense, then you don't get to come into the Asclepium, which means you don't get a medical attention then. What do you do? Your kid just fell down and broke his leg. Do you worship Asclepius and get medical treatment or not? But you're a Christian. You're a follower of the way, Jesus. What do you do? Everywhere you looked, there were temples and shrines to the gods, goddesses, and emperor of Rome. The pressure to engage in worship was knit to being patriotic and loyal to Rome. Pergamum was known for its loyalty to Rome. Fitting into the community and having your basic needs met. Well, you better worship the gods and goddesses that provide your basic needs. So participation was critical to simply surviving one, and then more. Oh, business, we got to get going on that. Now what's fascinating is most of the structures are built with black stone, but in Pergamum, there is a white stone that they excavated, and on this white pillar or stone was inscribed a decree that Caesar Augustus was the one who was Caesar when Jesus was born, and so Caesar Augustus, which we read about a little bit, they did put a decree on a stone here that said that his birthday should be made a national holiday as well as marking the beginning of the new year. So it's a new year. Yay! Well, he's no dummy. Caesar Augustus says, so we'll mark this as a national holiday and we should make it the new year. So anytime we turn the page and everyone gets excited about life, who's at the center of it? Caesar Augustus. So, most of the temples and statues they did were made of black stone, so they used white stone to highlight inscriptions and titles of the gods so they would stick out more. Because if you try and do engraving on the black stone, it doesn't show up well. But if you do it on white stone, you can actually display it a lot better. Now, just with that little bit of information, which maybe you're like, oh, that seems like a good amount, we can now sink into the letter to Pergamum. And we'll read this, and then we'll unpack it a bit. Revelation chapter 2 is where we'll be, and it's verses 12 to 17, a little longer than the last one. So we begin, to the angel of the church in Pergamum. Write. Now again, angel can be messenger. It's also translated messenger, or ethos, the spirit, the ethos of this community. To the angel of the church in Pergamum, write. These are the words of him who has the sharp, double-edged sword. Sound familiar? What is being said right away? Because Jesus is the one who said to John, who's writing it, John, write what I tell you to write down to these churches. Jesus says, I am the one who holds the double-edged sword. Jesus holding it means he is claiming authority over life and death. You see already how subversive this is. No, I am the one that holds the authority over life and death. But what they don't do, notice Jesus doesn't even going to, he's not going to name their name. I'm not going to give them that kind of attention. But the imagery and the language is there for them to know. Yeah, I hold life and death. I know where you live. Jesus says, where Satan has his throne, yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith. Now, this word faith in the Greek is the word pistis. Go ahead and say pistis. Pistis is best translated trust. We say faith, and that's fine, but often, too often, in our Western American world especially, faith typically, people will be like, well, it could be beliefs. And then we go to the head. And so when we say trust, hopefully that gives us a bit more, well, I don't just trust with my head, I have to trust with my life. And so trust, pistis is the way it's translated, trust in me. You did not renounce your trust, your faith in me. Not even in the days of Antipas, my faithful pistos, which is execution of commands, one who followed through with the commands that I gave him. Witness, so even though this Antipas, this brother in the faith, was martyred in your city, he was put to death in your city, where again, Satan lives. Jesus knows this city is the seat of Satan, the accuser, and it's a title. It's not like, well, this guy, Satan. It's an accuser. So who is the accuser? Well, here's the thing when you're in Pergamum, take your pick. Well, you have Zeus, who has an altar there, so he has a throne there. Athena has her temple there. Asclepius has his home there. Demeter, home. Proconsul, the governor, the proconsul, has his home there, has his throne there. So, or Dionysus, the god of the theater. So when it says Satan has his throne there, you're like, well, which one? Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. So all of these people, gods, myths, make their home here, and they, all of this is to invite you to compromise your trust in Jesus. Put your trust in us. So although one of your brothers was martyred, you hung on and you proclaimed, and that's important, you proclaimed Jesus as Lord. So as to say this, you've all announced that Jesus is the King of Kings. And now writing, when John writes this, some of the language that is all found in the Gospels, John gets to pull from and say, you all live into the reality where you believe Jesus is the King of Kings. Jesus is what? The way, the truth, and the life. John is the one who said that, right? You believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. This is where it's found. Jesus is the vine, we read in John's Gospel, who brings life. Jesus' first miracle was what? Water into wine. What would that also be doing? When there's a God who's the God of wine, and Jesus says, let me take water and turn it into wine, please. That's a party trick for me. Not Dionysus, get out of here. Jesus is what? John tells us too. Jesus says that he is the bread of life. What is all this doing? What is all of this language in the Gospels and then throughout doing? It's subverting a whole empire, a whole way of thinking that is prevalent and dominant. Jesus is the great healer. What does Jesus do throughout the Gospels? What do they constantly have Jesus doing in their stories? He's healing people. If Jesus is healing people and they're like, this guy, and then it says crowds come to him, this guy's healing, then who are they not going to? Or where are they not going? To the Asclepium. Okay, verses 14 to 16. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. So here we go again with this language that would be found at the Domitian Games, Domitian being the emperor at the time of the writing of Revelation. He was the emperor in Rome from 81 to 96. So at this is writing, nevertheless, I have a few things against you. So Jesus is saying, here's what I have for you. You've hung on, proclaimed the truth in the midst of all of this. You've hung on to it, and you've stayed true, trusting this in the way you speak. Great. Now, here's what I have against you. And so this is what Domitian would do. Governors of your territory, here's what I have for you. Great job. Here's what I have against you. Fix it or I'll wipe you out. Jesus says, here's what I have for you. Here's what I have against you. Fix it or I'll remove your lampstand, your menorah. As in other words, you can't be my church if you're not going to live this way. So it says, there are some among you who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed sexual immorality. Well, what does that sound like? Now, you actually find this story because now what John's doing is he's going back into the Hebrew scriptures in the book of Numbers, chapters 22 to 25, homework assignment, go read that, and you read about this Balaam and Balak and the story, but he's using that story to highlight all of this idolatry that is going on. Balak, if you read the story, sees the writing on the wall that Israel is powerful and he will eventually conquer Moab, and Balak is the king of Moab. And so Balaam is a world-renowned prophet. And so Balak knows the writing is on the wall. Israel's going to conquer Moab. They're strong and powerful. So he hires Balaam to curse the Israelites. Balak says, Balaam, will you curse the Israelites? Balaam says, I'm not going to do that. I'm not cursing the Israelites. But he teaches Balak that if you entice Israelite men to sleep with the Midianite women, they'll cave and worship their gods, which is exactly what, who does that? These other gods, that's what, so he's just telling the story, but he's going to use their scriptures. I'm going to use our story to get at what they're doing. And so instead of just saying, hey, you're following that God, you've bought this old story that has been told time and time again, and now the Greeks and the Romans are telling the same story, and you're buying it. You're buying into that old teaching. This was the way of saying that you are participating in the sexual parties in honor of Jesus by using the Hebrew scriptures, but he doesn't name the pagan God. Jesus is not going to give them that attention. I'm not going to say that. And John, we say this is apocalyptic language in Revelation. John is writing it so you can't just read it and go, oh, that, well, you can't. You're saying don't bow down. You're out of here. So instead, they write in this way. It's actually quite brilliant, correct? Likewise, so next, likewise, you also have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Second time this comes up. The church in Ephesus was warned about the Nicolaitans. Repent, turn around, turn away from that, turn toward Jesus, turn back to Jesus. Repent, change your thinking. Your thinking has been corrupt. Otherwise, I will soon come to you and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. Now, the Nicolaitans, as we highlighted, were ones who said, listen, here's the thing. Let's all get together. We don't believe this stuff. We don't buy any of this. But if we don't worship, if we don't offer incense, and we don't say Caesar's Lord or whatever we need to say, we'll probably die. They'll kill us. We won't get food. You got to provide. So the Nicolaitans were a group that came along and said, you don't buy it, but you better just jump through the hoops. And Jesus is saying, don't do it. That's compromise. Don't go the way of the Nicolaitans. Says it in Ephesus, says it again here. Don't compromise. So these two references notion, and this is, they hold the notion, and this is where it's really critical, that these things that are being taught, both of them, think of that, Nicolaitans. Okay, just say it, but you don't believe it. So you're going to say some things. And then the other thing of like, you hold to that old thing where you're going to go and jump through these hoops. You're going to participate in things so people think, well, they belong to the community. See, they're going along with these practices. What that is saying then is where Jesus is like, let me compliment you. You're proclaiming the right things, but your practices are these. So what it's saying is they're trying to play the game that our beliefs can be separate from the physicality of life. I can believe a bunch of stuff, and it doesn't like, but that doesn't like the physical, and it doesn't impact the spiritual, is how we might say it. Food and sex are physicality. They're not spiritual. So we can act in certain ways, but it won't affect my heart or my soul. So the thought went, which was only a belief back then, right? You see where we're going? Because how many people today go, well, I can say this, I can do that, and like, but what I do too, it doesn't really affect what I believe. Verse 17, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Again, this is going to circulate. It's going to move through these churches in Asia Minor. To the one who is victorious. Remember that word? Nikeo, Nike. Victorious in the Greek is Nikeo, which is the goddess of victory. But the one who is victorious in Christ. I will give some of the hidden manna. Oh, I've got food for you. I will also give that person a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to the one who receives it. The food Jesus gives is whole life satisfaction. Do not play around with the manna over here. Demeter, please. I have food that satisfies your entire being. And the food sacrificed to empty gods and goddesses will not. The name that Jesus gives you is known only to you because it's intimate and it's found only in the intimacy that you would have like in a covenant relationship, like in marriage, which is the fidelity and trust that we have in Christ. And when it's spoken of then as the church is the bride of Christ, there is this back and forth imagery of, yeah, it's that kind of intimacy. And knowing that this name that I give you, it's only you can know that in this kind of relationship. The promiscuity found in these pagan feasts that they were having, in these public wine parties where you get drunk and sleep around, is empty and it's old. It's the old story. He says, I'm going to give you a new name. That kind of activity, that's old. That's the other way. You and I have a new name in Christ. The invitation is to find your new name sketched on a fresh white stone, crafted by Jesus, which also this is touching on the Hebrew prophets, this new name and a white stone. It's pulling from the Hebrew prophets as well. This name is not, it's carved through fidelity, not compromise. Intimacy is being known as only your Creator can know you. So when we go to the very, very beginning, it says man and woman, humanity is created in the image of what? This God. This God. That's where your image, that is where your core is found. That will sketch. Abiding in me, being made in the image of the divine. So this letter has encouragement for a verbal belief in Jesus as healer, soul food, satisfaction, and the one who redeems. And it challenges the idea, this church in Pergamum challenges them, that you can hold these beliefs intellectually but behave and act in whatever ways get you ahead, feel good, or help you fit in with everyone else. That's what the church in Pergamum is doing. Yeah, well, we believe all this. We trust Jesus. We trust Jesus. We trust Jesus. But we have to jump through these hoops otherwise. And Jesus comes to them and says, oh, I got a message for you. Do not behave this way. You trust me? Trust me then. I don't want to just hear lip service. I want to see life, living, action, way. Follow me. So I was reflecting. I was writing more as I sat and thought about my time in Pergamum, looking at the temples, the ruins that are there, that it, obviously just see that they've excavated. Here it all stands still. This is the remains of what was. I couldn't help but contemplate what our brothers and sisters in the faith had to endure. Oh, that in and of itself, I remember in the upper city before going down to the Asclepium, sitting, I sat in the theater. just looking out over and weeping. They had to put up with this. Look at these temples. Look at these massive ruins. This is their society staring them in the face, saying, bow down. They had to endure a lot, and it was bow down or I'll kill you. And oh, by the way, the proconsul doesn't have to appeal to Rome, which is what? Legal? Like, he's his own law. I have the right to death, so their law says. So then I was confronted with the thought, what would I choose if I was in their sandals? Would I compromise and give in to comfort and blending in? So reflecting on that, and then studying, I came across a scholar named Howard Snyder. He writes some fascinating, brilliant work, and he offers some tests, a test on recognizing counterfeit gods. So just as a practical thing, I wrote this down, and this is a test that you can take, if you will, or hold, and so I'd love for us to have it. The test of time and devotion. How much time, money, energy, thinking, and loyalty are given to certain things? So these are tests. Howard Snyder says, let's figure out if we have any false counterfeit gods in our lives. Well, what kind of time, money, energy, and devotion, thinking, loyalty are given to this thing? What can't I live without? Go ahead and write it down. What can't I live without? And then the test of willingness to evaluate and question. Super convicting. Am I willing to consider that this thing has become too important to me? Or do I just dismiss it? What am I unwilling to consider? What am I unwilling to consider? Today I had a conversation with somebody who just will not own alcoholism. I can name it. Time and time and time again. They won't own it. It's not a problem. You're begging for money right now. What are you going to do with it? You're going to go buy. And you say, you asked for money for groceries for the kids. But when pinned down, you're going to go buy alcohol. Yeah, it's no big deal. But it's not a problem? Mm-mm. Come on, get out of here. Get out of here. So are we willing to evaluate and question? All of it, it's all out there. The church, will you be willing to be transparent and just list? Let's consider these things. You have all full rights to our books. Look at where we spend our money. Look how we do this thing. We'll show you what we value. The test of public signs of devotion. Is it obvious to others what I care about? You want to know, go ahead and grab your closest friends and ask them, what do I care about? It might scare them a little bit. Ooh. No, please tell me what I care about. Be honest with me. Be honest with me. What do I care about? What do you see? What do others say matter most to us? Test of lifestyle. What behaviors and results follow from my focus and worship of this? What behaviors and results follow from my focus and worship of this? So when I sit with somebody and I listen to them talk about some things and then I go, yeah, and your kids are suffering. And tell me this. So last section. Some questions then. Am I becoming more like Jesus? Because in Pergamum, they have Jesus and they have all of this chaos. Lots of it, obviously, that we just highlighted. So am I becoming more like Jesus? How do we differ from culture? Do we just blend in? Are we hospitable? What are our parties? Because Dionysus throws parties. Dionysus throws some big time parties. So the question is, do we just go, well, no, well, we don't throw parties. Are you kidding me? Jesus is like, you better throw the best parties. We're the church. We should throw the best parties. Absolute best parties. Ones that are honoring and are rooted in integrity and value people created in the image of God and celebrate life? Yeah, great, let's do that. Are we kind, loving, generous, peacemaking? This is the letter of Pergamum.